This week, The Spectator will surpass the 100,000 subscribers mark for the first time in its long history. Subscribe today and you could be our 100,000 subscriber. If you are, you'll win a prize worth £5,000, including a year's supply of Paul Roger champagne and tickets to our famous summer party, COVID guidelines allowing. We'll also send all new subscribers this week a commemorative tote bag. Subscribe today and you can get your first month free at www.spectator.co.uk/milestone.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Bulls. So today, the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, was on the airwaves to talk about something other than the pandemic. Katie, he set out reforms that he wanted to see happening in the NHS. Can you tell us what they are?
Yes, so Matt Hancock was talking about this idea of reforming the health and care services so they can work more closely together. And he was suggesting that this would bring various changes that would allow a focus on the health of the population, not just the health of patients. This is something we knew was coming, but I think that in terms of the timing, Labour have been questioning it, wondering really if in the midst of a pandemic, given we're not quite out just yet, and depending on who you speak to, we're quite a long way from being out of it, is now the time to be shaking things up. And on the proposed legislation, part of what the shake-up will see is a law change, so you're ultimately reversing the reforms of the NHS in England under David Cameron back in 2012. So I think a lot of this is about almost, you know, ministers are very keen to say they're taking control. So it's taking power away from the NHS and making it more direct. They say therefore it'll be more accountable. But I think often you get quite a lot of tough rhetoric. And the question is, does that mean there'll be more responsibility and you'll be able to say, well, this went wrong because of this decision by this person, or will it actually be easier said than done?
James, what do you make of the reforms firstly, and secondly, social care was notably absent from the suggestions as well?
Yeah, so it's worth going back to kind of genesis of the Landsley reforms. The idea was that Tory modernisers looked at how New Labour had taken some of the politics out of the economy by giving the Bank of England independence, allowing it to set interest rates. And that was perceived to have dealt with a traditional Labour weakness. The idea was to kind of take the politics out of the NHS by, you know, by basically having kind of a ministers not being in direct control of it. It obviously has not worked, which is, you know, when the NHS is still a heavily political issue. And I think the feeling in government is, you know, if they're going to be held accountable for it, they at least want to be able to pull the levers and have something happen. I mean, that was that sense was enhanced by some moments in the COVID crisis when they were very much reliant on persuading Simon Stevens of things that they wanted him to do. And, you know, I think one of the tensions with the vaccine, or I think the vaccination program has been a success, but I think that, you know, one of the reasons we get a daily number is that some people in government were like, well, only by getting a daily number will we be able to stay on top of this. Otherwise, it will be in an NHS system and we won't know quite as much about it. So I think the daily number was almost a way of putting pressure on the system itself. Now, I think you raised a very interesting question about social care and what they're going to do about this. I mean, this is a debate in government. I personally think that given what has happened in care homes, the excess deaths there that have been kind of appalling, I think the government is going to have an answer on social care by the next election to explain, you know, how this won't happen, how you've better joined up the link between the NHS and social care. And it's also going to be particularly important because the NHS waiting lists are growing all the time during this crisis because hospitals are so stretched. You know, at points they've been 40% above the previous levels of surge capacity. Lots of other medical procedures aren't happening, or people aren't presenting to hospital because they're concerned about possibly catching COVID if they did so. And so there is obviously going to be a big waiting list backlog at the end of this as well.
And Katie, speaking of healthcare, it seems like the Tory lockdown sceptics, who have been quite quiet in recent months, better behaved, have now woken up from their hibernation today.
Yes, we've had, I think, Steve Baker, Mark Harper, among those who have been, you know, citing concerns for some time, but it definitely has been the case that they have been a reduced force in the sense of fewer interventions and not the same number of people as previously. What I think we're starting to see is it's down to a few things. I think the 10-year sentence, as we discussed on yesterday's podcast, this idea that if you put the wrong thing on a form, you could have 10 years in jail about where you're coming from. I think that has riled a lot of MPs. And then I think, secondly, you also have a situation where at the moment you have on various broadcast programs, sage scientists, epidemiologists going onto the airwaves and saying things, suggesting that social distancing will have to be here for some time to come. One figure asked, I think, on Peston last night, you know, do you think the rule of six will have to be here all year? Now, that in the answer didn't specifically say it would be, but they did talk about how some measures would be and this idea of having to vaccinate everyone and second doses. And in that, I think you have a bit of a vacuum that these voices are filling because the government does not want to go near talking about relaxing restrictions. They say it's far too early in the course of this lockdown and pandemic. And although we are hearing we're going to get a roadmap on the 22nd, that has now changed to the week of the 22nd, rather necessarily the Monday. And again, a lot of, I suppose, not quite negative media, but just not positive. So I think that if we think back to the days when Boris Johnson was talking about Freedom Day, when we'd get to Easter, or even Matt Hancock, when he spoke to James and Fraser in The Spectator saying this great British summer, you now have a situation where yesterday ministers can't decide whether you should even risk booking a staycation in the UK this summer. Now, is it because their new thing is to under-promise and over-deliver? Because I think even if that's the strategy, it's getting to the point now where they are so keen not to promise anything, perhaps even the fact that you could like travel by an hour by August from your house, that I think it is starting to have quite a negative effect in terms of morale in the parliamentary party. And I'm sure elsewhere in terms of, you know, for example, like, I have been seeing lots of announcements saying, you know, weddings being cancelled, people complaining about that, but also businesses must be wondering really what this is leading to. But it is leading to more Tory MPs in terms of Parliament questioning. I think that we're going to start to see more of that now picking up ahead of this roadmap, which is ultimately, I think that people need a sense of, doesn't have to be exactly when things are going to be open, but what the strategy is to get back to something approaching normal life, because the new concern is that with variants and so forth, actually, it's just going to be quite far from that.
James, has the government changed the goalposts, at least in their own minds? I mean, it does feel like, you know, before, whereas vaccine was talked about what it takes to have freedom, now we're hearing about vaccine passports, quarantine measures coming in after vaccination. You know, is it just Tory lockdown sceptic paranoia, or are they actually onto something?
So I think Katie is right, that the tension is this, is there's an odd juxtaposition. Yesterday, Boris Johnson was saying, we're going to have vaccinated everyone over 50 by the end of April. In times past, that would have been regarded as a kind of, you know, moment of celebration. People would have basically said, oh, you're doing the one-dose strategy to give people protection. That means 2 to 3 weeks from then, you would have dealt with a group who, given protection to the group who Jonathan Van Tam, the Deputy Chief Medical Officer, say account for kind of 99% of deaths and hospitalizations. And at that point, surely the restrictions go. The government are very cautious about what they're saying. So Boris Johnson is saying that on vaccinations, but not saying what it leads to. And I think Katie is right. I think if there isn't some sense in that roadmap on February the 22nd, but the vaccination programme is a means to an end, it's the way to get back to normal, people will be irked. Now, I think the way to think about this is that the government, essentially, they're kind of three buckets here. And have I stopped? Have I said this on the podcast before?
I'm not sure if you said it on the podcast before or not. You said it to me, but I look forward to hearing it again, so I'm sure the listeners will too.
Apologies. So I mean, the way to think about it is that there are three buckets, right? Which is, there are domestic restrictions, border controls, and a kind of rolling vaccination programme. Now, we know that we are undoubtedly going to have a rolling vaccination programme. AstraZeneca have said that they will have the Oxford AstraZeneca team has said they'll have a new jab ready for the autumn. I think we can...
Prime Minister confirmed it this week at Prime Minister's Questions.
I think we can expect an autumn-wide vaccination programme. I think the only thing that is up for debate is whether that is only the vulnerable, or whether it is everyone will go and get the shot designed to kind of boost them against the South African mutation. And then the particular change, this is way beyond my GCSE biology, which is happening to the spike protein, appears to be happening in organically in other places other than South Africa. So that change, right? That I think we definitely will have. Then the next question becomes, border controls and domestic restrictions. Essentially, the view of some is that, you know, the more border controls you have, the more domestic restrictions you can have, because the greater protection you have against the variants. That's the argument for this. I think Boris Johnson is very reluctant, as you see at PMQs now, to go further on the border controls point. But I think it will be very, very hard. I think in June, the government will have to come to the Commons and try and get a renewal of the COVID powers. It'll be very difficult in June if it's more than 3 weeks on from all over 50s having been jabbed to get parliamentary support, to win a majority of Tory MP support for continuing strict restrictions. Now, if you still had a restriction in place saying that you had to wear a mask on public transport, or you had to have venues that wish to have more than 100 people had to have a certain level of ventilation, I think people would be perfectly prepared to go along with that. I think the idea of that, you know, you would turn up in Parliament in June, and I don't think this is what the government intending, but I don't think it would be parliamentary possible in terms of Tory party management to start and say, yes, we've decided to make it a rule of eight now, or exclude children from the rule of six. You know, there is a sense that this needs to happen. And there's also this other thing that she's driving Tory MPs' concerns, which is, you know, talk to cabinet ministers, all talk to business in their constituency, and despite the schemes, businesses are beginning to run out of money, and businesses are beginning to say, look, if I'm not going to get to open, and not open at kind of one third capacity, then I'm just going to throw the towel in. I mean, there is a worry that unless you get some things open shortly, by kind of say May Day, bank holiday weekend, that kind of time, businesses are just going to go under. I think one good way of thinking about it is, depending on which sport you want to choose, England play India at Lord's in a test match in August, or first day of the football season, how many people will be in the stadium then? You know, will it be back to normal capacity crowd, or will it be half capacity, or will it be some tiny number of people? You know, which one is? And I was pushing a government minister on this question yesterday afternoon.
Is this kind of lobbying?
but possibly.
If he talks about it on the podcast.
Obviously, if the ECB do get a full capacity crowd at Lord's and they wanted to invite me as they go. And this person was going to refuse to answer the question. They said, look, the one thing I will tell you, though, is that everyone who's there will have had their vaccine. And I think this is an interesting question, which is, where are we going on that front? Now, I then said, what? Because the government's going to say, no. But the obvious implication being that the venues would be demanding that. But I think this is an interesting question, and it comes to the cover story in this week's Spectator, which is all about this question of immunity passports and how far the government goes on that front.
And Katie, finally, today EU negotiator Maros Sefcovic is in London to talk to Michael Gove about the latest in Northern Ireland. What's been happening there?
Well, we've seen the Northern Ireland Protocol come under lots of focus and a push from the UK side to change various things. And this all goes back to the vaccination hoo-ha, is that the right word? Perhaps it's more drastic than that. But ultimately, when we had that weekend where the EU just decided to invoke Article 16 of the Northern Ireland Protocol over this row about vaccine exports, their concerns they didn't have enough vaccines. And that clearly had quite quick repercussions in the sense it was widely condemned across the political spectrum. The Irish government hadn't been notified by the EU. And in the days that followed, you saw at least reports saying, you know, the situation had got worse in Northern Ireland in terms of the border. You had certain checks stopped because staff didn't feel safe or there were concerns for their safety. And now we have seen a push from the UK government side to say to the EU, look what you did. Let's work to make the protocol work better for everyone. Now, James, who I'm sure will come in shortly, has written a very good column in The Spectator this week explaining some of this, because there were problems with the Northern Ireland Protocol before the EU invoked this article. It has not been working in the way that ministers had hoped. And I think to a degree, some of the things they signed up to are problematic. There's also parts of it, I think, that are manifesting, which you didn't quite expect, but it is creating a real problem. And I think that in terms of how you move forward, there's a sense that the current way the protocol is working is not sustainable. And therefore, can they use almost this political capital from the EU messing up to get the EU to bend? As things stand, I think the EU are quite reluctant.
James, talk us through some of the problems that you pick out in your column and how you see these talks going.
So You saw Clement Beaune in the French Foreign Minister basically accused the UK of trying to use kind of blackmail to kind of renegotiate the protocol. And I mean, there is a kind of a suspicion on the behalf of some EU member states that the UK is trying to do that. Now, the UK is trying to get away from some of the things that it signed up to in the protocol. But what is also becoming clear is that the protocol, which is not yet, I mean, there are grace periods at the moment. This is going to become stricter. It is losing the confidence of the unionist community in Northern Ireland. You've had the DUP come out against it and pushing the UK government to Article 16. And I think this is where, as Micheál Martin, the Irish Taoiseach, said, you know, people need to cool it. People need to think. Now, let's step back. You know, let's step back here. The whole point of the protocol was meant to be to try and square the circle of protecting the single market and protecting the peace process in Northern Ireland. The protocol is not going to protect the peace process in Northern Ireland if it becomes loathed by one community.
But the unionists never liked the protocol in the first place, and that was one of the reasons Arlene Foster fell out with Boris Johnson.
Yeah, but what I think is clear is this is no longer something that politicians don't like. This is cutting against ordinary people's lives in Northern Ireland too much, I think, and that they are finding that firms won't deliver to them. There is too much disruption in their everyday life. It would be one thing if this was something confronted by large businesses, or, you know, this was the point is you're getting to a situation where a gardener in Ballymena tries to order some bulbs and finds that they can't get them. They're told that they can't have them delivered to them because they're in Northern Ireland, and part of the problem is that because the Northern Irish market is relatively small, lots of British firms firms in Great Britain are essentially saying they don't want to go through the faff, the bureaucracy of trying to make a relatively small number of deliveries to Northern Ireland, and so aren't bothering. But I think this is becoming a threat to these voters' identity as British. And I mean, that is problematic for two reasons. One is it could turn the Stormont election next year into a proxy referendum on the protocol. Even if unionist parties, as the polls currently suggest they would fail to get an anti-protocol majority in the Assembly, it would clearly be destabilising for the protocol to become a kind of defining issue in Northern Irish politics. And I think this is the case for some compromise on both sides. And I think you're probably looking in the territory at some kind of thing where goods would have to be over a certain value to trigger all of these processes and checks. So if things are clearly for not going to be a threat to the integrity of a single market because they are too small in volume to be worth smuggling off the island of Ireland and into another part of a single market, then there would be no checks made on it. The paperwork wouldn't apply. I think you have to do something like that, because otherwise this is going to become a running sore in Northern Irish politics and destabilising. I mean, look at the fact that of the 2017 DUP vote, 23% have already gone to the more hardline traditional unionist vote, according to traditional unionist voice, according to the latest Lucid Talk poll.
We'll be following that on Coffee House Shots and more. James and Katie, thanks very much. And do join us again tomorrow.